mentioned Luther yesterday, and I just picked off the shelves in the library, and it's against the law to take this book out of that room, so don't you do that. But it's volume 21 of the American edition of Luther's works, and it's on the Sermon on the Mount and the Magnificat. I thought I'd read a couple of passages so you get some flavor of Luther talk. In the preface he says, "I do not doubt that here I have presented the true, pure, and Christian meaning to my friends and anyone else that's interested. It is beyond understanding how through his apostles the wicked devil has managed so cleverly to twist and pervert especially the fifth chapter, making it teach the exact opposite of what it means. Christ here deliberately wanted to oppose all false teaching and to open up the true meaning of God's commandments, as he emphasizes when he says, Matthew 5:17, that's the verse we're going to look at today, 'I have not come to abolish the law.' He takes it up piece by piece and tries to make it completely clear. Still, the infernal Satan has not found a single text in the scriptures that he has more shamefully distorted, and into which he has imported more error and false teaching than this very one which Christ himself ordered and appointed in order to head off false doctrine. This is really the devil's masterpiece. First, this fifth chapter has fallen into the hands of the vulgar pigs and asses, the jurists and sophists, the right hand of a jackass of a pope and his mamelukes. Out of this beautiful rose they have sucked and broadcast poison, covering up Christ with it and elevating and maintaining Antichrist, etc." Luther is characteristically humble about his own reading of the text. I think I mentioned specifically his reading of "Give to him who begs from you," and the way he says there might be an occasional exception to that rule. Here's Luther on Matthew 5:42. "The Christian should be willing to lend and give to anyone who asks. Yet, if he knows that this is a scoundrel, he's not obliged to give it to him. Christ is not telling me to give what I have to any scoundrel that comes along and to deprive my family of it or others who may need it and whom I am obliged to help and then to suffer want myself and become a burden to others. He's not saying that we should give and lend to everybody, but, quote, to him who begs from us, end quote, that is, to the one who really needs it. Not to the one who develops a whim that he would like to take something from us by force. Such people are well off enough already, or they want to support themselves at other people's expense without working. Therefore, it is important to be careful here and to ascertain what sort of people there may be in the city, who there is poor and badly off and who is not, rather than to let in any vagrant or tramp who is not in need and could very well support himself. There are plenty of such people roaming around the country nowadays, whom I would call Squire Filth. They would like to take advantage of this teaching and use it to have a good time with other people's possessions until they're all used up, wandering around from one place to another. Such people should be turned over to the police and taught something different instead of deceiving pious folk with their mischief." Well, we got a little flavor of that. And if you would like, you can go into the library and get volume 21 and read Luther on whatever passage you might be interested in reading him on. Yesterday we talked about some issues and some options, and it might sound a little bit to someone as though that's just playing games, just like to monkey around with academic questions or some such thing. To me it's not that at all. It is rather a recognition that we are members of the body of Christ, that the Holy Spirit does not begin with us, that we read the Bible as a book of the church, that we pay attention to one another, that we listen to one another, that we learn from one another, and that when we choose, Rich said this morning that that people are choosers, people are deciders, and when we do that, that we do it with some knowledge of what the live alternatives are. And so I tried to say yesterday that there are there are more than I mentioned, fundamental approaches to the Sermon on the Mount. And how you read an individual verse or passage is obviously going to be affected by what you think the total passage is about. So today I would like to go to a verse, 5:17, with a very important verse in the fifth chapter, where Jesus says, "Think not that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets. I have come not to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot, will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Whoever then relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven, but he who does them and teaches them shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." And that's the lead-off passage into six antitheses in chapter 5, where in each case Jesus picks up a specific from the law and says, "You have heard it said," and then he says, "But I say to you," and then he says something else. "You've heard it said, you shall not kill, but I say to you, everyone is angry with his brother. You've heard it said, you shall not commit adultery, but I say to you, every man who looks at a woman lustfully," etc. So we're going to look at that passage, 5:17 through 20, particularly 5:17, "Think not that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets. I've come not to abolish them, but to fulfill them." Now, that verse is one which a whole cluster of people have huge difficulties with. Jesus says, "I came not to abolish the law and the prophets. I have come not to abolish them, but to fulfill them." Some of you know the name of Archibald Hunter. He's a British New Testament scholar, and he has written a lot of popular books. Some of you know Barclay. Archibald Hunter is kind of a Barclay type person, very conservative really. But when it comes to 5:17, he says, Jesus could never have said this. He simply could not have said that he didn't come to abolish the law, because obviously Jesus did come to abolish the law. We all know that. We know that from Paul. The law is bad. Jesus came and clobbered the law and replaced it with something else. So Hunter says Jesus could never have said this. Obviously, the early church placed these words into the mouth of Jesus, and this is not the word of Jesus at all. A German interpreter of the New Testament, there are many, many people, these are just illustrations, Hans Bindisch, has a very important book on the Sermon on the Mount, in which he says, there is no way that you can put 5:17 together with the Apostle Paul. That if you think Christianity is the grace of God, if it's the forgiveness of sins, if it is the Spirit rather than the law, there is no way that you can read 5:17 together with that. So Vindisch says, from the viewpoint of Pauline Christianity, 5:17 is total and complete heresy. Okay? Marcion, some of you know his name, early church father, what was it, 2nd century, 3rd century? Somebody knows? I'm not sure. Way the world back there. Marcion was a person who read the Apostle Paul and was really turned on by all that gospel, not law business in Romans and Galatians. He was a kind of a super Lutheran in a way. And he said, "Wow, this is it. We don't live by the law. We live by the gospel." And so Marcion decided the Old Testament has to go. I mean, that religion of the law, that was a different God from the God of the New Testament, who's the God of grace and good news. So Marcion fleshed the Old Testament. Then he came into the New Testament and he found, gee, there's a lot of Old Testament in the New Testament. I mean, there's a lot of quotations of the old law. We just take our scissors and clip those out. Huh? So when he got through with his Bible, Marcion had like the Gospel of Luke and a smidgen here and there of other things and like Romans and Galatians. Marcion was a Lutheran run amok And he was so sure that law is only negative, and it is totally opposed to spirit, totally opposed to grace, totally opposed to good news, that he wound up with a completely emasculated Bible. And he said on Matthew 5:17, although there's no textual evidence whatsoever to support it, Marcion said that what Jesus really said was, "Think not that I have come to fulfill the law. I have come not to fulfill the law, but to destroy it, to abolish it." So Marcion said, what Jesus originally said was the exact opposite. And it was Matthew who was hung up with the Old Testament and law and all that junk, who reversed it. Okay? Now, the people that I've referred to are people that are in the bloodstream of most of us, I think. That is, we are inclined to think that law has very little positive role to play in the living of the Christian life. We tend to like very much Luther's statement that good works don't make a good man, but a good man does good works. We tend to like very much when Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, you're crazy if you think that it does any good to tie good fruit on a bad tree. What's necessary is for the tree to become good, and then it'll just bear fruit naturally. We tend to think that the good things that people do simply flow out naturally, spontaneously, out of a redeemed self. Anders Nygren of Lund, Sweden, has an extremely important book written many years ago, some of you know it, entitled Agape and Eros. And you know that those are two Greek words for love. And Nygren thinks that Christianity is about agape. You've all heard that term. And agape, for Nygren, is diametrically opposed to nomos, the law. Nygren says law has nothing to do with Christianity. Law is opposed to agape. Agape is, by definition, spontaneous, unmotivated. It just comes out of the faucet. It just flows. The good person just does good works. The good tree just bears good fruit. If you take that and run with it very far, then you wind up with Archibald Hunter, Hans Windisch, and Marcion. And you have a lot of problems with Jesus saying that he came to fulfill the law. Okay. I would like today to argue a case for a more positive reading of the law. Yesterday I talked about some options. Today I'm talking about one option. I'm trying to promote something. I'm trying to argue a case, and we'll have some time for conversation, and you can come back at me. The talking about Christian life, Christian deeds, as arising spontaneously from a new heart seems almost axiomatic to most of us, seems self-evident. But it's not the only way of thinking about things. For instance, there is a long tradition, primarily in the Roman Catholic Church, it grows out of Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas, which says that goodness does not come spontaneously, but goodness comes through instruction, goodness comes through habituation, goodness comes through practicing the virtues. We all have the potential for goodness, but the trick in life is to actualize that potential, and that doesn't come all of a sudden with conversion. But it's a process of maturation. It's like the acorn that gradually becomes an oak tree. It's like the baby that gradually becomes a mature adult. And so the law becomes extremely important, because the law is an embodiment of the virtues, Aristotle would say, or the right and good life, as St. Thomas would say. And sometimes we, in fact, all the time, maybe, we have to do things unspontaneously. We have to almost make ourselves do things in order to habituate, in order to form, in order to mature into something that we are not. So that law takes on a completely different cast, and it takes on all kinds of positive rather than simply negative connotations. Now that's kind of where I'm going to come out. Let's look at the text a little bit and see what we can see in terms of the actual text of Matthew. Last week we talked a little bit about 1 Corinthians 12 through 14, and I hope it was clear that the great passage on love, 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians, is ununderstandable unless one sees it in the context of 12 to 14, and unless one places 12 to 14 in the context of the whole Corinthian correspondence. Well, in the same way, Matthew 5 through 7, the Sermon on the Mount, is ununderstandable unless one sees it in the context of the Gospel according to Matthew. Okay, so maybe we ought to ask about Matthew's Gospel. All of the Gospels answer the question, who is Jesus? Every writer in the New Testament answers the question, who is Jesus? That's what the New Testament is about. But they answer it each in his own way. I guess in the case of the New Testament, it isn't appropriate to say his or her own way. Unfortunately, we only have male authors here. Each in his own way. And Matthew, I should say, answers the question, who is Jesus, by saying he is the promised one. He's the promised one. If you take the Gospel of Mark, Mark begins, the beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ, Son of God, and then he talks about John the Baptist and goes into the story. Who is Jesus? Jesus is the Son of God. Look at Luke. Luke says, inasmuch as many others have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things accomplished, blah, 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 I think I'll put my hand to it too, and so on. John says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word became flesh and dwelled among us. John pushes the question, who is Jesus, all the way back to the origin of the cosmos. Now Matthew begins his gospel in quite a different way. He moves directly to the genealogy of Jesus, and he takes great pains to connect Jesus with Abraham and with Isaac and with Jacob, with the patriarchs, and then with David, with the monarchy, and then with figures from the Babylonian captivity. And Matthew is saying, who is Jesus? Jesus is the promised one. He is the one who has come to us through this long line of God's chosen people. And in 1:22, after the genealogies, Matthew says, all this took place to fulfill, there's our word from 5:17, all this took place to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet. So he begins immediately to say, who is Jesus? He is the fulfillment of that long line of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, David, etc. He's the promised one. And that formula, this took place to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, occurs in Matthew 11 times. And you can go through Matthew and find those passages, it's punctuated. The Gospel of Matthew is punctuated with that formula. This is the place to fulfill, it's our word again, what was spoken by the prophets. Beyond that, there is a movement, I think, in Matthew's Gospel from an exclusivity to Israel, which broadens out to the church, which finally broadens out to all nations. So that in chapter 10, verse 5 and 6, Jesus says, he sends out his disciples, and he says, go nowhere among the Gentiles, but go only to the lost sheep of Israel. So that in the same way that Matthew begins his gospel with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the story of Jesus begins with the people of Israel. But by chapter 16, he says, you're Peter, and upon this rock I'll build my church. There's a movement toward the Gentiles. And in 28, he says, go to all the nations, and lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. So there is a kind of a, conical structure to Matthew's gospel, beginning with great particularity in the people of Israel and moving out into cosmic proportions. Beyond that, we mentioned yesterday the formula in Matthew's gospel when Jesus had finished these sayings occurs five times. The first time at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew takes his material and arranges it in five hunks. And at the end of each long discourse, now when Jesus had finished these sayings. And Matthew is very consciously saying, there are the five books of Moses, but here are the five books of Jesus. So that the very shape of that gospel is fivefold. And Matthew almost visually, imagistically, is saying, hey, Jesus is the fulfillment of the five books of Moses. That's what Jesus is all about. So that the whole structure and the whole wording and the repetition of phrases and passages and everything in Matthew's gospel seems to me to be saying that Jesus is the promised one. Okay, let's go back to that verse 5:17. Think not that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets. I have come not to abolish them, but to fulfill them. One thing that's interesting to me in that passage is that the Marcions and the Hunters and the Windishes and the Super Lutherans see the word law there, but somehow or another they don't see the word prophets. It doesn't just say, I came not to abolish the law. It says, I came not to abolish the law and the prophets, but to fulfill them. But people are so worried that Jesus is going to say a positive word about law that they don't even see the word prophets there. And as a matter of fact, the word law occurs only three times in the Sermon on the Mount, and every time it occurs in the context of the word prophets. So Jesus is talking about the law and the prophets, which is a kind of symbol for the entire Old Testament. When Jesus says, I've come to fulfill the law and the prophets, he is saying, I came to fulfill the history of Israel. And Jesus is quite capable of talking about false prophets, as well as he is capable of talking about misuses of the law. So the law can be used positively or negatively by Jesus, but also can profit. And we tend not to do that. Philip Melanchthon, one of the writers of the Lutheran Confessional Statements, says, lex semper accusat, the law always accuses. The law is always negative. That's part of the stuff in the bloodstream of most of us. So that we tend to say, for instance, about preachers, at least preachers talk this way. I think that non-preachers talk this way, too. We say, well, he's a law preacher. Oh, I mean, bad. We associate that only negatively, but we say, oh, a prophetic preacher has a prophetic ministry. That carries only positive notions. Why is that? Well, it's very clear that law can be positive or negative, and there can be false prophets as well as true prophets. Each word can be used with negative or positive connotation, but our particular bias tends to read law only negatively and prophets only positively. Okay. I have come not to abolish but to fulfill the law and the prophets. What about that word fulfill? It can be used in at least three ways. If you look in a lexicon, many uses of the word fulfill, but it can be used in at least three ways. First of all, the word fulfill can mean to obey the law. Jesus came to fulfill the law. That means he obeyed the law. He fulfilled it by doing all the right things. Secondly, to fulfill the law can mean to fill the law full of its intended meaning. Okay? Third, to fulfill the law can mean to bring the law to its intended end or completion or fulfillment. Those are three distinct uses of the word fulfill, and what you think God and Jesus and the Bible are about is going to feed into which one of those you choose. The first one, it seems to me, can hardly even be taken seriously. That is, that when Jesus says, I came to fulfill the law, he meant, I came to obey it. I came to do all the right things, because that's simply contrary to the gospel narrative. Jesus is breaking the law right and left all over the place. That's where he gets into all kinds of conflict with the Pharisees. And besides that, it is a moralistic understanding of fulfilling the law that seems to me to be out of keeping with the whole drive of the New Testament. Meanings 2 and 3, it seems to me, have some cogency. The second one was to fill the law full of its intended meaning. Now, if you go following this little passage into the antitheses, you've heard it said, but I say to you. What is Jesus doing there? The Roman Catholic tradition said that what Jesus is doing is to make the law more stringent, to internalize the law. You've heard it said, you shall not kill, but I say to you, whoever is angry with his brother. You've heard it said, thou shalt not commit adultery, but I say to you, whoever lusts after a woman. What Jesus does is to make the law tougher, to internalize it, to make it a matter of the heart rather than of external actions. Calvin said the same thing. Luther said, no, no, no. To do that is to make of Jesus a new lawgiver. But Jesus is not a new lawgiver. What Jesus is saying here is, you have heard it said, that is, you've heard people say on the street corner, but I say to you, what the thing really meant in the first place is, it's very different. It is not to add something to the law, it is to fill the law full of its original intent. So if you remember Luther's talk on the Ten Commandments in the Catechism, he says that thou shalt not kill means that you should help and befriend your neighbor in every time of need. Thou shalt not commit adultery means that you should live a chaste and pure life. Thou shalt not steal means that you should help your neighbor keep and protect his property and living. So Luther says that what those negatives mean are really positive, and he's not adding anything to it. Jesus didn't add anything. That's what the thing meant in the first place. I'm much attracted to that, that Jesus is not adding something to the law. He's not internalizing the law. What he's doing is saying, you people have screwed up the law. You've heard it said. What it really meant was, okay? Thirdly, the law, to fulfill the law, can mean to bring it to its intended end, to its intended conclusion. And I'm opting for, I'm arguing a case here, I'm opting for meaning number three, that when Jesus says, I came not to destroy the law and the prophets, but to fulfill them, what he is saying is, look, what the law is about is like an arrow. It points to something. Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and the Exodus and David and that whole history has a forward thrust, and it says, hey, the promised one is coming, and I'm here. I fulfilled the law because in my own person, I bring the law to its intended conclusion. Okay, if that is the case, then it is impossible to talk about law and Jesus as contradictory to one another, if Jesus is the one to whom the law points and in whom the law is fulfilled, the law and the prophets fulfilled, then there is some kind of continuity, some kind of congeniality between law and Jesus. Okay? That means that we begin to look at all of these ethical, moral statements in the Sermon on the Mount in the context of the person of Jesus in whom they find their fulfillment. Joseph Sittler says it beautifully, it seems to me, talking about the commands and the commander. He says that you have commands in the Sermon on the Mount, but what the commands are about is the commander who made the commands. And that if you cut the commands away from the commander, you don't have the commands anymore. Because what they're about is the commander in whom they are fulfilled. So it's the person of Jesus that the Sermon on the Mount is about. Now, I think there are many ways in which that can be demonstrated. One way, for instance, is to compare the material in the Sermon on the Mount with the outline of Mark's Gospel. Would somebody turn to Mark 1:39, please, and read it for us? Mark 1:39. Anybody? That's fine.
And he preached in their synagogues throughout all Galilee and cast out devils.
Okay, that's okay. You could have and he preached in their synagogues in all Galilee and cast out devils. Okay, here is Matthew 4:23, and he went about all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and preaching the gospel of the kingdom, healing every disease and every infirmity, etc., etc., a few other things, and correspondence between Matthew 4:23 and Mark 1:39 is very, very close. Would you read Mark 1:40 then, the next verse?
And there came a leper to him, beseeching him, and kneeling down to him, and saying unto him, if thou wilt, thou canst make me clean.
Okay. Matthew 8:1, when he came down from the mountain, great crowds followed him, and behold, a leper came to him and knelt before him, saying, Lord, if you will, you can make me clean. Okay? Mark is the first gospel written. Matthew has Mark available, so does Luke, when each of these people write their Gospels. Mark 1:39 equals the material just before the Sermon on the Mount. Mark 1:40 equals the material just after the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew places 5, 6, and 7, these words of Jesus, wedges them into the space between Mark 1:39 and 1:40, which is to say that the words of Jesus here are significant in the context of the story of his life. That if you miss the fact that the good news is about Jesus, then you might as well forget these words on the Sermon on the Mount altogether, because what they are about is him. So that you find all the way through the Sermon on the Mount a tremendous attention to Jesus' own person. In the Beatitudes he says, blessed are you when you are persecuted on my account. He says in chapter 5 over and over again, but I say to you, they're amazed at him because he speaks with authority. So the first person singular is over and over and over again in the Sermon on the Mount, namely saying that that the words of the Sermon on the Mount are significant in the context of his person. Okay, what that means then is that Jesus comes to fulfill the law and the prophets, and that means that law is connected with the person of Jesus, and that makes everything look a little bit different. W.B. Davies, who has the major critical work on the Sermon on the Mount, places at the frontispiece of his book Matthew 11:29, which says, take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. And that figure, yoke, comes straight out of Judaism, and it means the law. That's what the word yoke means. And Jesus says, take my yoke upon you. Paul uses the same phrase in Galatians when he talks about the law of Christ. Even Paul can talk that language. Take my yoke upon you, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Okay, if it's about Jesus, and if Jesus is the promised one, then it is really important that both in the Sermon on the Mount and the Sermon on the Plain, the material begins with the Beatitudes. Blessed are you. The commands are in the context of the declaration of God's gracious gift and purpose. Blessed are you. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst. Blessed are the merciful. Blessed are those who are persecuted. It's gift, it's sheer grace, because it's Jesus Christ. And so then you begin to think about the law as something in the context of the person of Jesus, who is the fulfillment of the law and the prophets, and who is the specification of the love and the mercy and the grace of God. And the commands become gracious commands. The yoke becomes easy, and the burden becomes light. The law isn't done away with, but the law is radicalized in the context of the gracious person of Jesus. So that all of these commands become gracious promises. And the you musts become you will. So that, for instance, you take at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, you must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. You interpret that moralistically and it'll kill you. You must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. But if you understand Jesus as the fulfillment of the law and the prophets, then what that says is, hang in there with Jesus, and you will be perfected. You will be brought to completion. You will be allowed to become that which God intended you to be. You will be blessed. You will be able to actualize your potentialities. And the commands are signals, are signs, are indications from our Creator and Maker and Redeemer of the direction in which that maturation process ought to move. Okay? You will be perfected. You will be blessed. You will be brought to your appropriate end. Okay, that is an argument about a notion of the law which is different, I think, from that which most of us have flowing through our veins. Let me, just in a couple of minutes, suggest what that might mean to take that seriously. It would mean that we forget about the fruitless attempt to put all talk about the law in simply one of two buckets. That is, either you're a legalist or you're free from the law. Either the law is a way of salvation or the law is nothing. Huh? What I'm saying is, what I think the text says is, there are more than two alternatives, there are more than two options. We have to begin to think of the law certainly as potentially destructive, but also as potentially helpful. Hmm? And so some of the classic notions about law may need some new look. For instance, the notion of natural law. Natural law theory says that there is some kind of moral structure to the universe, some kind of moral structure to the creation, that in some such way that a person can say, I don't believe in the law of gravity, and jump off the Empire State Building, he's going to make just as big a splash on the street corner as the person who does believe in the law of gravity. It's just there. Natural law theory says that there is a kind of a moral law built into the universe, that it does make a difference what individuals and groups of people and nations do, how they behave, and that the God who made this world knows something about how the thing works and how people live together. And so when he says, hey guys, if you want to make it in this world, if you want to make it with one another, if you want not to blow the place up, here are some things you might try doing. The law is a gracious gift of God for non-chaotic, non-destructive existence. He knows something about how the thing works because he made it. So that maybe we have to take a new look at natural law theory, and that would mean, you see, that we do not live the Christian life just out of spontaneity, just out of the, quote, spirit's leading, just out of what turns us on, just out of what we at the moment think is right, but we hook ourselves into the long history of God's people and the long history of the creation, and we look forward toward the consummation, and we try somehow or another to make it in that long stream with some attention to the laws which hold the place together. So a new look at natural law. Another thing is that that perhaps we ought to consider the order gospel law rather than the order law gospel. Some of you know what that means, some of you don't. Lutherans say you have to talk about the law and then the gospel. You have to preach the law and then the gospel. First you have to club the daylights out of them, and then when they cry uncle, then you say, ho, Jesus loves you, everything's okay, and then you come back next Sunday, you beat the daylights out of them. First the law and then the gospel. That makes the law completely negative again. Karl Barth says it's not law gospel, it's gospel law. that God says, I'm the God who brought thee out of Egypt. That's gospel. Then he says, now here are a few suggestions. The Ten Commandments follow the gospel. First 11 chapters of Romans, pure grace. Chapter 12, okay guys, now present your bodies a living sacrifice, and he moves into an ethical section. Three chapters of Ephesians, pouring out the grace of God, good news. Then he says, okay, you catch on? Now, lead a life worthy of the calling to which you've been called. So that law grows out of gospel. It isn't opposed to gospel. And Barth says, and I agree, that the law, rightly understood, is a form of the gospel whose content is grace. All right, our time is running out. Could illustrate that in lots of other ways. What I'm basically saying is that I think Jesus, contrary to Hunter, Vindish, Marcion, and all their friends, I think Jesus did say, I came not to abolish the law and the prophets, but to fulfill them. I think that what he meant was that he's the promised one. He brings the law to its intended end. And it seems to me that has lots of implications for how we ought to try to live the Christian life, and lots of implications for trying to work out some positive relationship to law. Okay? Of course, that's a nifty word, law. It has all kinds of connotations. There's scientific law, there's civil law, there is law in terms of Ten Commandments, etc. But the word, law, ought to carry to Christians not just negative but also positive connotations. I went longer than I ought to have, but we have time for conversation. What would you like to say? Yes.
And we really said often as Lutherans that the law is for the non-Christian and not being for...
Lutherans have said, all, not only Lutherans, Calvinists, Roman Catholics, have talked about two or three uses of the law. First use of the law is to restrain evil. You have to say, stop at the red light, and you have to back that up with force, because if you don't have a law, people are going to run the red light and kill one another. So the law is to restrain evil. That's the first use. The second use is that the law is to drive us to repentance. It says, here's what you ought to do, and you don't do it. So you have to repent and be forgiven. Those are two uses of law that's accepted across the board. They're both negative. The third use of the law, people argue about whether Luther taught it or not. And there's all kinds of sophisticated arguments about textual glosses and all kinds of junk. But the issue is that the third use of the law is supposedly as a guide for Christians. Once you're saved, then you want to know, what should I do? Here's the law that tells you what to do. But mostly, Lutherans have rejected the third use of the law and have said that Luther rejected the third use of the law because the law obviously can have nothing to do with the Christian life, which is spontaneous and led by the Spirit and flowing out like the good fruit from the good tree. Huh? So we have not, I think, had very much machinery, actually, for talking positively about the law. Now, you can take the first use of the law, and instead of saying simply that it restrains evil, you can say it is God's ordering of his creation. And you can turn that first use into a more positive sense. I think that's a major thing. I think that in the end of the late 60s, early 70s, somehow or another, Christian theology and... the street rhetoric of the protest movement combined to talk about law and order as only a dirty phrase. And so law was negative, order was negative, and we had Theodore Reich's Consciousness 3 and Rozak's Making of a Counterculture, and goodness and purity and truth were to reject the law, to obey the law, to disobey the law, to protest the law. I was in Selma myself. I disobeyed the law. Huh? I don't think that's all bad, but the whole flavor of the time was that. And I think that was disaster. you know, not only in the church but in the nation. It is impossible for people to live together without some kind of positive connotation to law. Society is impossible without law.
Yeah. Thinking through your, you know, bringing the law forward, could it be that, you know, Christ always spoke in parables, that he was speaking to a crowd of people who may have been thinking civil law, the law of the time, I am here breaking all of your laws, but really, I am talking about the law of God, just like when he died, he said, thy will be done, okay? He's speaking of God's law, they're thinking of their law, and he's trying to get the point across that perhaps when they finally realize that he is fulfilling a law which is in fact of a higher plane than their civil law, that we're talking about, you know, one law going this way, their civil law perhaps going at a little bit of a cross current to it, but not necessarily opposed to each other. And that his whole life on earth is nothing but a fulfillment of God's law. And you know, we're talking two completely different laws here. The will of God is the law that he's responding to, because he is God. And there's no conflict even with carrying the law forward. When you think in terms of the prophet, okay, you're carrying the will of God forward. And when I think of the will of God as both the prophecy and the law, there doesn't seem to be any problem.
I guess that I would not be inclined to drive that much of a wedge. I realize you didn't say they're in absolute opposition. But to drive that much of a wedge between civil law and God's law, because Jesus is talking throughout the Gospels with Pharisees, with Sadducees, with Essenes, with people for whom there is not that distinction. God's law has to do with the body politic as well as with their relationship to him, and it's all mixed up together. And so Jesus does not simply ridicule them or throw out their notions of the law. He enters into discussion with them. He argues with them. And I think he's arguing about the same, he's arguing about the will of God, which has to do with our relationship to him, but also with our relationship to another. I think that civil, ceremonial, and moral law are all intermeshed in the Bible. So he's not talking about one rather than the other. He's talking about an interpretation of the whole ball of wax, I think.
It seems that he's trying to tell them to look at their civil law in the context of the moral law, so to speak, which is what he represents.
Well, but they also thought they represented the moral law, and Jesus was also interested in civil law. I think there's a real danger in making that kind of a separation. The Torah in the Old Testament, the law in the Old Testament, was that all of those little dietary laws and all that stuff, not eating pork had something to do with the, you know, the possibilities for eating pork and staying healthy, and the lack of possibility for eating pork and being healthy. All those little things had to do with the total life of the people of God. And the moral and the ceremonial and the civil were all intertwined. Life is a totality, it's a whole. And I guess I think that's terribly important to say, for us too. Yeah, Keith.
It seems that one thing that's happening, which we talk about law this day, is that we can talk with other people and use that word in a way that maybe will help to pull it back into a vocabulary of poverty. And maybe we can establish some kind of talking with people who already have positive feelings about law. I see that as an advantage, but I'm having a problem with understanding how it is then that Jesus has a redemptive character for me or function or where my hope is, because I'm struggling with, you know, requirements, I'm struggling with figuring out what my tradition and the realities of the world and what the traditions of other people, how they come together and some good thing happens. Now, I know one thing that you said about how his yoke is easy and his burden is light. I think it comes in at that point. And maybe then maybe that's the place for me to find this thing, namely that my understanding of the requirement, if they feel heaven, can't be what Jesus' understanding of it is. Is that where the hope lies for us?
I think two things, Keith. One thing is what I said Saturday night in that thing, that we have to, if we think about the law this way, we have to readjust our heads to think that something is right, not because God commands it, but God commands it because it's right. I mean, he knows something about this place. Huh? It's not wrong because God prohibits it, but God prohibits it because it's wrong. And I mean, it's really neat to be allowed to get in on the way the thing works. Isn't that neat? Huh? That's no terrible burden. That's gift. That's grace. To be allowed to get in on the way God made this world. So it's a, one has to adjust one's head, I think. That's one thing. The second thing I've lost it. and it was so important. It was so terribly important. Sorry, it may come back.
I was wondering if this, the way he, laid this out so perfectly, and with the five references to the five books and all, if this was, this gospel might not have been more or less written with the Israelites in mind.
With the
Jews.
Oh yes. Matthew is the most Jewish gospel. And it is written with them in mind, and it is written with very much in mind with their misuse of the law. Oh yes. So he is correcting. He's correcting them.
Yeah, it seems to be more quotes too from them.
Oh yeah, that's why I said that the whole gospel just screams out, he's the promised one. And where are the promises? The promises are to Israel. So he fulfills the law and the prophets. He's the one to which it all points. Yes, and if one forgets that setting for the Sermon on the Mount and thinks that, well, here we have the pure, naked, true moral law or something like that, that thing is totally misread. Okay, tomorrow we'll look at chapter 6. There are three nice little things there where Jesus talks about giving alms and praying and fasting, and he says in each case, you do it in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you. And we're going to look at that and try to say something about the visibility of the Christian life and the hiddenness of the Christian life.